Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be back in the United States and be back in Tennessee and to have a chance to talk with longtime ally and amazing precious metals dealer and farmer and author, Franklin Sanders. So, Franklin, I've missed you, and we're delighted to have you back on the Slayer Report.
Well, we've missed you, too. Good to be back.
So, trying to make sense of the markets may be beyond us all at this point, but you've prepared some charts. So bring us up to date on what's happening in the precious metals market and what you see.
Let me just preface what I'm going to say by saying this. I know that you've fried eggs, right? I mean, everybody's fried eggs at some time or the other.
Uh-huh.
And you know how this goes. I mean, think about it in slow motion. What happens is you get out the skillet, you put some grease in the skillet, you let the grease get real hot, hotter the better, I think, and then you crack the egg on the side of the skillet and you open the egg, and sometimes that membrane on the inside fights you just a little bit, and then you want to drop the egg into the grease just right so that the yolk doesn't break. Well, in slow motion, that's what we're watching. The eggs have been cracked. They're just being dropped into the grease now, and the frying's going to take place pretty soon. So that, just bear in mind that what I think has happened is the shells have been broken. The egg's been cracked. And what we're watching now is sort of the, in slow motion, is the takeoff, the real frying of the egg. So having said all that, I've got a chart here of the gold Philadelphia Bank Stock Index, and that's the gold price divided by the Philadelphia Bank Stock Index. And the reason I've got that up there is very simply this. Physical demand does not drive the price of gold or the price of silver. I mean, most of the gold that's ever been mined is still in existence. So you can't do commodity type supply demand analysis for gold the way you could for oil or oats or wheat or something like that. So it's not that kind of physical supply and demand that drives the price of gold and silver. What drives that price is monetary demand. And monetary demand is the inverse, or the reciprocal, if you will, of trust in the financial and monetary system. So what we've got here is when people don't trust the financial and monetary system, they go into gold. They buy gold. When they trust the financial and monetary system, they buy bank stocks. So what you've got here is a spread that seesaws between confidence and no confidence. And what I'd like to point out is this. You've got a slightly downtrending channel, that's those green lines on there, that ruled for, several years, about 4 years. And then back at the start of 2016, the gold bank stock index broke up. In other words, gold began strengthening against bank stocks and blasted straight up. You can see that long run. And then it came back, and it's been sort of settling back in a downward trending channel. But think about that green line there, which is a long-term line. And what markets often do, what markets usually do, is when they make a significant breakout, they run up, and then it's almost as if they think about what they were doing, and they run back to get one final kiss goodbye. So that's what it appears to me that this gold stock index is doing. It's going to go back either to that line or to the 200-day moving average and get that final kiss goodbye before it takes off to the upside. But the breakout over the long-term downtrend line says that the trend has changed. The egg has been broken. So that this chart right here is, to me, the most important chart for understanding gold. I may be overstating that a little bit, but not much, I don't think. And then the next chart I've got is the gold-silver ratio. And that's just the price of gold divided by the price of silver. And if you can't tell from the shorter term chart, but there's a range, and the top of the range is about 84, and the bottom of the it takes 84 ounces of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold. And the bottom of that range is, say, 45. And if you looked for the last 20 years or so, you'd see that the spread, the gold-silver spread, stays within that range. Occasionally it'll go way up to the top and go to 84, and then occasionally it'll go past the bottom, went down to 32 back in 2011. So what we know is that gold and silver are languishing. They're not doing well when gold is outperforming silver. And by outperforming silver, I mean that ratio is up toward the high end of that 84 to 45 range. Well, it got there back in March, after dropping back. It got there back in March, and look at what happens. It's just since the 1st of March, that ratio has just simply collapsed, which means that silver has been outperforming gold. And it's a general truth to say that silver rises faster than gold in a gold and silver bull market. That's a general truth. It doesn't mean it happens every day. But the fact that the ratio has broken from 84 and broke out of the channel it was trading in, has that heavy red line is the long-term uptrend line from 2011. So it's walked through that line. Now it's broken down from the trading channel with those two nice gaps, and now it's traded back up to the 200-day moving average, which is about the same place as the bottom boundary of the channel. So that's another market that says the egg's falling out of the shell, it's on the way to the grease, and it's fixing to fry big time, because that ratio may go a little higher in this correction, but there's nothing in the gold-silver ratio in that chart that I see now that says it's going to go much higher. It might go back to to 80, which is the point of that triangle that it broke down out of. They do that sometimes, but this says that gold and silver have turned up again. And then I've got the dollar index, and the dollar index is what, that's the third chart. That's the chart that's got everybody wringing their hands now. You know probably more about the imposters in the Federal Reserve than I know. But what they do is they have these lying mouthpieces that they send around the country, and for a process they call jawboning, which is that they talk markets up or down. Now, without ever lifting a peg, without ever turning a peg, turning a screw, nailing a nail, making any change whatsoever, from July of 2014 to March of 2015, that jawboning drove that threat, we're going to raise interest rates, we're going to raise interest rates, drove the dollar up from 80 to from about 80 on the dollar index to 100. They didn't do anything else. They took no steps. They didn't change anything that we're doing.
I do think they did something, and that is they lent dollars all over the world. And then as commodity revenues fell, you had borrowers all over the world in a dollar trap. And so
they're in one now, sure enough.
So it wasn't just threatening to raise interest rates. It was basically, creating a huge lending business in dollars and then turning around and making dollars a little bit scarce.
But that's apparently they have been working against since December. There was another high in the dollar index in December, but it was a failure at 100 to 1. And just from a technical standpoint, that, followed by lower peaks, defines a market in a downtrend. And so it's been
I don't think the Fed, you're in a funny, the Fed's in a very funny situation. Not that they're necessarily in control, but, you know, it is, if you want to keep the stock market high, then you need a lower dollar. In other words, the rise of the dollar up to 100 has been devastating for a lot of the S&P earnings, because you've got a big position in multinational earnings and you're consolidating back. And so I thought the dollar was going to go much higher, but from what I've seen, the corporate pressure to keep the dollar lower and the cut that it's put in the S&P forward earnings is very significant. So I think the political pressures to keep the dollar within a band are pretty high.
Well, I don't doubt that. So, and here the Fed is the creature, the servant of the big banks. And while they obviously target keeping the stock market up, they also want to do everything possible to make life easy for those banks. And
right.
If they create a worldwide shortage of dollars, they have to make sure that the dollars will come back to the United States, and the only way to do that is to keep that dollar high. So,
right.
But clearly, since we know they manipulate interest rates, I can see what they're doing. I said manipulate interest rates. Of course they do, but they manipulate currency exchange rates. And you can see on this chart what they've been doing. They've been letting it go down. Now it got down to the bottom of the range. It got down to 92.5. In fact, spiked through that one day. And now suddenly it turns around and goes up the other way. Now, technically, you can say, well, yeah, it got to the bottom of the range, it bounced off the bottom of the range, and it's going back up. Right. But what I see here is there's a policy decision here. And the policy decision was to cheapen the dollar. Although, you know, I hear all these voices now say, oh, they've sent people around to say they're going to raise interest rates. And obviously the reason they do that is to jawbone the dollar up. So I don't know that I know what it means, but I'm
right.
What they're doing.
Well, what I think that they really did want to raise interest rates, you know, a nominal amount each quarter, and then when things started to come apart in February, particularly in China, I think they got scared and backed off, and that surprised me. I mean, it surprised me that they backed off.
Why did it surprise you? I mean, these people are a bunch of spineless academics. I don't see them as brave economic warriors out on the front leading the battle.
I'll tell you why it surprised me, because I'd assumed there was enough strength in the general economy globally to do it. And if you look at what is happening to the insurance companies and the pension funds as a result of basically lower interest rates, it seemed to me that you could absolutely do a nominal amount each quarter and just let market adjust. I mean, I can't tell whether they really thought, that you could end up with a bad spiral down in Asia or globally, or we just have gotten to the point where we're afraid to let market adjust and to take the pain. I don't really know what happened, but I think they were really committed to try and raise interest rates, because the number one problem in the U.S. economy right now is the pension funds. I mean, you're talking about a model that blows up the basic, you know, the basic business model of the insurance companies and the pension funds is being blown up right now. And if you don't start to let them roll over at a slightly higher interest rate, that problem is just going to get worse. So I think they were really committed to doing that, and they backed off because they got scared. But the question is why? And I don't just think it's...
Go ahead.
You know, I think you're right that you got a group of academics, but the people basically telling them what to do, are not just academics.
Well, it appeared to me that they backed off because they were afraid they'd crash every stock market in the world by raising
rates. Right, I agree.
But you're right, they're in a trap, because pension funds are now beginning to go under. I mean, there's no way if you built a pension fund based on an assumption that you're going to make 6% and you make 0.5%, you can't pay out many years.
Right.
The Teamsters Union right now is the pension fund is negotiating with the pension what's the silly government agency, the Pension Benefit Corporation, yeah.
Yeah.
For a 60% haircut. They said we need to cut benefits by 60%, and the government said, oh no, that's not enough. That's not enough. Because their fund's going to be exhausted in like 6 years, something like that.
Right.
So,
right.
So the point that I'm making is, they're not the only one. During the 90s, all of these state pension funds and city pension funds and county pension funds made all of these promises to their pensioners about what they were going to pay based on these ridiculous assumptions of what they could make. And then when the stock market goes down for a long time, and when interest rates go to zero, there's no way they can do that because they're not earning any income to do it with.
Now, I would also argue that between pump and dump stock market fraud and mortgage fraud, there was a lot of money backdoored out of the pension funds that hasn't really ever been clarified and shown to, you know, happen. So I think the story is even uglier.
Well, but the bottom line remains, pension funds are in big trouble. And that requires higher interest rates. I mean, and not just a little higher, but significantly higher interest rates.
Right.
So now I've got a chart of the S&P 500. Looks like to me there's a head and shoulders top formation. The right shoulder's being filled out now. And I would expect, given, you know, the proverb, sell in May and go away, that probably you're seeing the end of this, and by probably the end of this week, it'll turn around and start going down again. Chart number five is gold, and this is gold since last November. And you can see there's this nice bowl-shaped formation there and an uptrend line. And gold was slung up out of that bowl and rose and then sort of stalled and went sideways for some time. And it really wasn't clear whether it was going to go sideways or it was going to make another leg up. Now it's correcting. That top red arrow points to the breakdown yesterday out of the out of that trading range or the uptrending range, and so that gives you a target down around 1205 to 1190, which would, you know, I mean, it's possible to go down to the 200-day moving average down there at 1161, but you're going to get some kind of correction. But the important thing to see here is what happened in December. That's the bottom after the correction that's lasted since 2011. That's the turnaround. And what we've seen, the rallies that we've seen, the amount of time that it's spent over the 200-day moving average, cannot be. There's nothing comparable in that 2011 through 2015. Correction. So I have no doubt that represents the bottom, but you're in the middle of a little correction now. And this would be an extremely good time to buy gold. And you're going to get that opportunity within, well, the next 2 weeks at the most. But once it starts falling out of, there's not much, there's kind of a lot of air. It was down like $8 this morning. Sort of a lot of air under there until you get to about $1,200, $1,190, something like that. And then I'm saved the best for last, the silver chart. Silver chart looks a lot like gold's chart in that it made a bowl back in December. slung up out of that bowl, and this really looks more like what's called a cup and saucer than a bowl. But in any event, it's sort of traded sideways. And then you see right there in about the middle of April, there was a range marked by those dashed green lines. There was a range, and it was trading within that range, and all of a sudden it broke up out of that range. Well, when a market does that, you can just flip the boundary over and, in other words, double the size of the range. And that's about where it'll go. And sure enough, it went just a little above the top of that range to 1806 and came back. And it's in the middle of a correction now that'll take it down to $16, maybe probably $15.50. The reason I say $15.50, you see that long red line that goes diagonally across there? That is the downtrend line from the top in April of 2011. This is the most significant breakout possible. So silver is out above that. If it comes back to that downtrend line, which today is about 1550, then it will get one. It will snatch one of those final kisses goodbye that I mentioned earlier, and turn around and run. But these two charts together, the gold chart and the silver chart, leave me firmly persuaded that we've seen the bottom in gold and silver, and so it'll be up from here. That doesn't mean you'll always get these thrilling runs like we had in February or, you know, even up into May, but you're going to get a steady advances. And that's all I'm...
Well, you know me, I'm always a skeptic. I do think low interest rates is going to be... I just expect interest rates to stay low for a long time. And I think that's going to be very good for gold and silver. But I'll tell you what has got me shaking my head, Franklin, and that is I remember in the 90s when I looked at what was happening with technology and I thought, okay, you know, we can disintermediate all the banks. And I vastly underestimated the political power of the banking industry.
Yeah.
But if you look at what's going on in terms of now, the effort to use technology to disintermediate the banking industry, I think it really is, there's a really good chance it's going to happen this time, and the big banks are in for real loss of market share in a very dramatic way. And I've been spending a lot of time trying to understand what blockchain technology is, how it works, and what it could do. And I don't know if you've been reading about or looking at all the fintech websites that are happening to try and disintermediate the banking industry, but I think the banking industry is in for a real period of enormous creative destruction. And so I just don't see how the banking industry does well, no matter how much money you pump into it.
Well, but, you know, as Joseph Stalin said, obsolete classes do not voluntarily leave the stage of history. Well, it's true. You know, they fight, they claw, they
right.
use all of their power. You know, I was sitting here listening to you talk about this sort of technology at the margin of newness, and the last 3 weeks, my last 3 weeks has been partially consumed, and my mind has been almost totally consumed reading a book that was written in 1935 called A World in Debt. And it's available in a reprint from India, and it's kind of funny because they've got it spelled D-E-P-T, A World in Debt. But it's a photographic reproduction of a book written by Tilden Friedman in 1935. And what Friedman does is lay out the blueprint, or the growth curve, if you will, of a credit bubble. And of course, we're in the greatest credit bubble the world has ever seen. Sure, the technology is different than it was in 1935. The way money is created is different, et cetera, et cetera. But, Catherine, I'm telling you, it's just like reading something that was written yesterday. It's just absolutely fantastic. And the thing is that he's a very engaging stylist, and he writes very plainly. And I keep pounding myself on the head of all the stuff I've read about debt, the problem of over-indebtedness, money, and so forth. How I ever missed this book, I don't know. But the conclusion that it leaves me with is that the banks are toast. There's going to be a default. There's going to be a massive default. And in a default, usually the creditor pays. The creditor pays off the debt. And so those banks, from the standpoint of the debt position that they built up, the credit bubble that they have blown up themselves, that bubble is going to explode. It hasn't near about exploded yet. I mean, we saw the real estate crisis and all that sort of stuff. But what I'm saying is the debt has not yet been written down.
So, but let's break it down. If you look at the U.S., what we did during the bailouts is we took all the debt on the bank's balance sheet and moved it onto the government's.
Right. Yeah, I understand.
And then in China, what it looks like China is about to do is basically write it all down. And a lot of the big banks with carrying a lot of the debt are government. So it looks like Asia, the government assumes, North America, the government assumes responsibility. Europe, increasingly it looks like the government is shifting it onto their balance sheet. And so the question is not will the banks blow up, but will the government blow up?
Well, one way or the other, the debt will be done away with. One way
right.
or the other. And I think, though, that the banks... That does not give, even though you're right, the banks were made whole, their balance sheets were made whole by the Fed, for instance, buying $4 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities and other trash from them. That's correct, but it's also correct to say that they have reached the growth, the peak of their maturity curve. You can't keep doing this. There's
right.
no elasticity left in the system for you to keep doing this. They built so much overcapacity, and consumers are tapped out, so they can't keep it going. What's the next credit bubble?
Here's the thing, that
will burst.
You know, the financial sector has grown and grown and grown, and it has grown in a way which is destructive on the productive economy. And, you know, it's like a big parasite. And, the amount of fraud in it can be debated, but, you know, I'm on the side that it's way beyond what anybody will admit or can fathom. And the game is up. And it's not just up here, but globally, the debt growth game is up. And the question is, how do we digest or get rid of the debt? I don't think anybody knows.
Well, it'll eventually be written off because it can't be paid. You can't grow your way out of the kind of the debt levels that we have. It's probably the total debt level in the United States, taking all of it into account, is probably 350% of gross domestic product. So,
I'm not so sure you can't. I think you can grow your way out of it, but as a practical matter, the politics of that are difficult to do. Right now we are in a period of tremendous productivity creation. If you just look at what's happening in energy technology and what is probably going to happen over the next 5 years in terms of energy, I mean, the price of energy is going to come down dramatically and stay down. And that's unbelievably wealth creating. But the politics of how you share that wealth, that's a whole nother thing. And if anything, the political structures are going, they're going the wrong way. They're destroying trust. So to me, you look at the whole situation and it's unbelievably fluid. So, but if you look at what's happening, I told you we did all sorts of analysis in the 90s that shows you if you just stop being lawless, how much wealth could be created. I mean, I continue to believe, lies and lawlessness is a taxation on the body politic, which is extraordinary. And if you took that off, great things could happen.
But that's not reality. That's not, you know, you're asking to go against the tide of 150. You're asking to go against a 150-year tide.
I'm asking to go against a 10,000-year-old tide.
The tide I was thinking about was the tide of state control in the United States and in the world, in Europe too. The idea that the state has to control everything. And you've literally gotten to the point now where I think behind the scenes, at least, they won't admit this in public, but behind the scenes, at least, they're controlling the prices in most markets. I have no question that the Fed targets the stock market. They keep one eye always on the stock market to see what that's doing. And I'm confident that the plunge protection team goes in there and buys stocks to keep it up. Well, how many other markets do they do that in? Oil?
Right.
We know they do it in interest rates. We know they do it in currency exchange.
Well, the oil is definitely a managed price. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the depositories, because there are signs steadily every day that the global trading system for gold and silver are being built out in a very interesting way. And we saw an announcement that the state of Texas is creating its own depository, which I think is a very significant development. I thought we might talk a little bit about that.
Well, they passed the law. The problem is that there's many a slip twixt cup and lip, you know. There's many a slip between passing the law and putting it into effect. And they haven't landed yet on a contractor who is willing to do the job that needs to be done. There's a big software job that needs to be done there. If you read the bill, I'm not saying it's impossible by any means, but it just looks like an expensive job to me to be able to keep up with not only transfers in and out of accounts and across accounts, but also acquisition costs. It appears to me that the bill requires them to maintain for depositors a record of the acquisition costs of their gold or silver. So anyway, it's a big deal. And then the way that the bill is envisioned is that it's not just one depository. There's a series of a chain of depositories and a chain of transfer agents all over the state of Texas. It's the best imaginable bill. I mean, it's way wiser than anything I would have sat down and devised. But the problem is finding that person who's willing to do it. Several people have said they would, but they just haven't stepped up yet. And you might be interested to know that we've got senators in Tennessee who are in favor of that same thing and have gone on the record in favor of it.
Do you think it's possible to support them in doing that?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure how much support would exist for that particular bill in Tennessee. I mean, I don't know. I spoke with a senator. This must have been in 2011. We were at the Capitol, and I went to see the state treasurer and talked to him, because they manage a huge pension fund. But anyway, the state senator said, you know what we ought to do? If you've ever been to the Tennessee Capitol, you know that it's built on the top of a hill. He said, what we ought to do is just dig down under this place, dig a big hole, put concrete in there, and have our own vault right here. And I thought, well, that's exactly right. And that's really what Texas has done.
But, you know, I'll tell you, just from talking with clients and subscribers all over the country, a state-controlled depository would be, it'd be like candy. Everyone's looking for a depository they can trust. And a state-controlled one would just be, you know, it would be the cat's meow. The demand would be off the charts.
And it's not certain that Texas would enforce this. But in the legislation, there is a provision that says they will not give over any gold or silver if the federal government confiscates it. So, I mean, if anybody would make good on that threat, it'd be Texas. I don't know that they would, but if anybody would, they probably would. So, yes, I think there's a huge demand for it. And it's not – see, what you haven't said is this is not only a place to store gold and silver, this is a liquefaction system.
Right.
This is a system that makes gold and silver so liquid they can be transferred easily. They can be transferred electronically. They can be transferred by check. And that the very problem silver and gold have now that prevents them as circulating as money is that they're not liquid, that they're not widely accepted. And if you can overcome that problem, like this depository would do, and have, you know, an office in every big town, my goodness, how long do you think it'd take for people to desert the dollar? I told Jim Turk back in 1991 when he got his patent on gold money, I said, you know, if the government will leave you alone, you could replace every national currency within 2 years by a gold-backed, you know, electronic money, or gold and silver. So anyway, that opportunity, that potential is there. I agree with you, and it is exciting. But they just have to come up with somebody who will pony up the dough and say, okay, we're going to build a system, and we're going to build the depository.
And then China, one of the large Chinese banks bought a depository in London.
Yeah. Did you need a can opener for that can of worms or what?
What?
Well, what I'm talking about is I get all these emails. There's all this buzz on the internet or fuzz on the internet about how the Chinese are going to replace the London gold fix. They're going to replace New York and London, and New York and London are crooked, and they're manipulated, and the Chinese are just right around the corner from replacing them, and the Shanghai gold fix is going to replace the London fix and New York COMEX. Well, that's not true. And the simple reason, I mean, I believe that the Chinese are trying to assume, to overthrow Anglo-American dominance and financial hegemony. There's no question about that. I would do that if I were in their position.
Right.
But you can't do that fast. I saw a graphic yesterday. I'll forward it to you. But from visual capitalism, 88% of the gold in the world is traded in London. 88%. And it's like,
right. So I think that's why they want to be there.
Well, sure they do, but the point is they're not. They didn't build that. They didn't buy that vault, dismantle it, and ship it to Shanghai. And another problem with Shanghai is if you put gold in there, you can't take it out of China. You follow what I'm saying?
Oh, really?
Gold can't be taken out of China. They consider it a strategic metal. So the fact that there's no free movement in and out is going to hamper them. That has to be changed. But I think their long-term plan certainly is to displace the Anglo-American gold trading establishment. But that's not going to happen overnight.
When I was in Brisbane, I stopped in the duty-free and got a new watch. And I started to put my credit card in a machine. She said, no, that's the Chinese machine. You want to put it in this machine. They had two credit card machines there. And so the Chinese won't take Visa or America or MasterCard. You've got to have UnionPay.
I think that's very clever. You know, they understand where American power comes from. And if they control all the payments in the world, you know, you don't have to get a very, very big piece of all the payments in the world to make a lot of money.
Well, the one thing I saw when I was in Asia was that is that Chinese structural reform is going to have a very big impact. And that is, you know, if you look at what happened from 1990 until 2008, essentially China was lending, was buying treasuries, and then the U.S. government was taking the money and sending people checks, and everybody was then going down to Walmart and buying Chinese goods. And so China built its manufacturing center basically on playing a game that kept extended the consumer purchasing power in the United States. And then that came to an end. And now China's trying to build its own you know, its own consumer markets, its own base, its own. So rather than financing America keeping their game going, they're financing themselves building their own game. And, you know, and whether it's trying to make their currency liquid globally or build out their navy and try and become a global military and satellite presence, you know, they're just building their own power. And that is a huge structural reform vis-a-vis the United States and the Anglo-American Alliance.
True, but I think the problem they face is that production comes before consumption.
Right.
And they don't have a middle class big enough to do the necessary consumption to keep all of their economic machinery going, and they've overbuilt hugely, and that's got to be worked out somewhere. And so there've got to be some bad years while all that stuff is written down and rationalized.
Right. It's gonna be, you know, to a certain extent, you see them running around the world trying to finance infrastructure and other things for everybody else, and that's trying to create demand. And one of the reasons, what I heard when I was in Asia, was interest rates are going to stay low because the excess capacity is unbelievable.
Oh, gosh, it's huge.
Yeah.
I was reading the other day, China has built something like 800% of world steelmaking capacity. They built that in recent years. Well, there's no way that they can absorb that kind of steel production. So that's over capacity, and all that factory has to be written off some way, written down, you know, done away with somehow or the other. So that's going to be a big indigestion problem for a while.
Well, there's a couple things I wanted to ask you about. I was in Australia for a week and a half, and I was in Sydney for the first week, and for 6 days, I was really going all over the place. I was going to business meetings. Sydney's right on the ocean. It's 5 million people. 42% of the people who live in Sydney were born in another country. It's amazingly multicultural, and just very cosmopolitan. It's so beautiful. And the lifestyle, everybody runs down to the beach and goes surfing before they get dressed and go to work. When I tell you, what a lifestyle. So, but it took me until the sixth day, Franklin, to see a police car. It got to be a big joke. Can Catherine, you know, find a policeman or a police car in Sydney? And, of course, I live in a place where you see 10 a day, and I'm in the middle of no place. So it was just astonishing, the quality of life and how safe everybody felt and how human everyone felt. Now, you have a much less dense country, but you know, coming back to the United States, I was just, I don't know, being in a place that had that high quality of life, I came back being much more intolerant of American politicians. It was quite extraordinary, and you realize the extent to which, you know, what's happening here. I'm struggling to find a word other than demonic. But maybe I shouldn't struggle. Just the, you know, the debasement, the perversion here is just beyond belief. But one of the things I discovered was the extraordinary fear of what's happening in the election here.
Mm-hmm.
And the extent to which Clinton is perceived very, you know, is very popular globally, whereas Trump is seen as, you know, horrible. Before I left, Peggy Noonan wrote an editorial, and she said, "Oh, great, now we have a choice between a criminal and a crazy man." And I was amazed at how a criminal was broadly socially acceptable based on what they said as opposed to what they did.
Yeah, but the criminal follows the globalist agenda, and the crazy man doesn't. And that's Clinton has always been an establishment character. I mean, she's been an apparatchik forever and ever and ever. And that's the reason why the media supports her and they attack Trump, and I have no brief for Trump either.
Right.
But that's, you know, I mean, that's what's going on.
Here's the thing. So let me grossly oversimplify and use an example. So the National Security Council with Bush at the helm and the Clintons in Arkansas worked to bring drugs into MENA, Arkansas. The drugs go into South Central LA, kill thousands, if not millions, of people ultimately as they build out across the country. That money is levered with mortgage fraud and mortgage securities fraud. It creates a huge amount of money that you throw at Silicon Valley, and you keep throwing that money at Silicon Valley long enough until, you know, they build a juggernaut of all the things they've built. And then, you know, then Silicon Valley comes and tells you how they're private entrepreneurs and they don't want to be bothered by government. And the San Jose Mercury News comes out, you know, in support of Clinton for president. Well, sure, because Clinton was part of a group of people which went out and got capital by stealing it from others and, you know, in what I would describe loosely as genocide, whether it was financial genocide or physical genocide. Now, that game works as long as you can pretend it's not really going on and you can continue to promote the appearance of the rule of law. So, not to belabor this point, but the Clintons were part of that group in Washington who thought it was hunky-dory as the government's bringing drugs into the community to drop SWAT teams, round up innocent kids, and throw them into prison where they make uniforms for the Department of Defense. Where I come from, we call that Nazi. So we're in a period where the secrecy is still good enough that everybody can pretend that the Clintons are, you know, part of a lawful system. But the reality is they're not part of a lawful system. And there are enough people and there's enough communication on the internet that we're all getting pretty mad about that. And it seems to me, if you look at the disapproval ratings on both Trump and Clinton, you know, I'm assuming they'll both be the candidates, although I don't, you know, it's still open for doubt. But either way, you're going to come out of this with half the country, you know, when the campaign begins, half the country not trusting, well, 100% of the country not trusting one of them. And that's before they start to have a food fight and point out their other, you know, I mean, we could end up in a campaign where the establishment really gets outed one way or the other.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of assumptions there. One is that Trump is what he seems to be, which I'm not at all.
Oh, no. So. I don't believe Trump is what he seems to be.
But there's something else interesting going on with Hillary, and that is that the mainstream media is publishing articles about her weakness. The mainstream media is publishing articles that are negative in one way or the other. And, you know, that would signal that somebody in the establishment would like to get rid of her. In other words, that would signal that maybe she's not going to be around come November. In other words, maybe something will happen between now and then. She'll get indicted and Obama will give her a pardon and the inside deal will be that she'll drop her candidacy if she gets a pardon. And, you know, that stuff is speculative on my part, but it's easy to see how she might be replaced. The question is, who in the heck would replace her? That's the horrible thought. I mean, what do you want, Bernie Sanders with his hand in your pocket? I mean, he's ridiculous. You know,
I'd rather have Bernie Sanders than Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump.
Oh, I hadn't. He's just an out-and-out
thief. Really?
Oh, yeah. Well, but, you know, but Trump, I can't see any good thing that's going to come out of Trump or that's going to come out of Hillary, except it may be that Trump might possibly accidentally fall upon some pro-American policies, either economic or military or something. And by pro-American, I mean stop all the wars. That's another thing that they thrive off of war, and they don't like Trump.
Here's the good thing I expect out of Trump. If Trump's the Republican candidate, I expect Trump to really raise a lot of serious issues. In other words, I think Trump is going to make it easy for people to have an honest conversation. So, you know, Trump came out and said Clinton, Common Core was a bunch of hooey we ought to let locals control. And whether he believes it or not, or whether he do it or not, who knows? But just the ability to have that conversation, you know, he intimated that heavy schedules of vaccines was a problem and might be connected to autism.
Oh, my God.
Well, how about that? Right, exactly. So what I expect out of Trump, what I'm hoping, at least we get an honest conversation. Now, but let me bring this back to gold and silver. So you said that the demand was driven by trust in the system. I don't see how we get out of this election with any trust. I mean, I think this is going to be very expensive on trust in the system.
Well, I think if you're shorting trust in the system, you're in the right side of the trade. There's no question about that. Yeah, but that you know, the central banks have been losing credibility increasingly in the last, well, since 2008, because the things that they've tried have not worked, but if you stand back and look at it, but increasingly since last September when the Fed blinked instead of raising interest rates, they've been losing credibility. And now government's losing credibility, and there are a lot of, I think there are more people than usual who look at the election and say, a pox on both your houses. I don't want either one of them.
Right.
And all of that adds up to draining trust out of the system, right? You're absolutely correct.
Well, it's interesting. I did not expect to. I got The Alchemy of, or the latest book by the former head of the Bank of England, Mervyn King. And I wanted to read it because I wanted to know what the enemy was saying. I never expected to like it, and I haven't finished it. But one of the things he points out is that money doesn't make the world go round. Trust makes the world go round. And the problem with what's going on is it's destroying trust. And it's a very eloquent description of why I believe productivity, you know, apparently productivity in the United States has collapsed. You know, we're not getting any productivity increases. And it makes perfect sense to me because, you know, the more we see from technology, the more technology is used to just centralize everything and make it, you know, make it more productive for a few people and less productive for everybody else. And so it doesn't surprise me at all. But I don't see how you get productivity rising when the trust is going out of a system.
And, well, you don't.
You don't, right.
Oh. Because that's all part of the social mood, and when the whole social mood turns down, then distrust is what you get. And when people are distrustful, they give less of themselves. So, yeah. Go ahead.
One of the Salieri reports we're about to do coming up is how to build a great local food system in your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you've been teaching us for many decades, Franklin, I think a lot of this all comes back to food. In other words, if we're going to rebuild the economy in a way that's good for all of us, one of the things we have to do is we have to have a revolution in food and food supply. And I would like to point out a couple of very positive developments. One is that Monsanto is basically failing, and the Germans are trying to pick it up cheap. But it's because it's hit a wall. And it just goes to show you that evil doing sometimes, you can overdo evil doing. That's number one.
Well, that's a relief.
But number two, you've had a whole series of companies, General Mills, Mars, a lot of big companies coming out and saying that they're going to not use GMO or they're going to do GMO labeling. And I think they're basically folding in the face of overwhelming consumer rejection.
You know, they're a huge part of the market, though. They're 80% of the corn,
right.
80% of the, or 90%, 80 or 90% of the soybeans, rapeseed. I don't know. There are all kinds of things that are GMO, and when they're, where they're GMO, they are nearly 100% of the market. So that would be a big change. But certainly that would be, to get rid of glyphosate, which is Roundup, is that that's number one on the agenda, to clean up to clean up the food supply.
Right.
Because they do you know, Catton, do you realize that when they harvest wheat, they go into the ripe wheat, and in order to make it dry, die and dry faster, they spray it with glyphosate. That's right, yes. So all the wheat that you get, I don't know that all of it, but most of it is sprayed with glyphosate, even though they're not spraying. You understand, they're not spraying the glyphosate for weeds. They're spraying it to kill the wheat faster and dry it. So
right.
I don't, you know how many more people nowadays are allergic to gluten or gluten intolerant and so forth, and it may be that there's a synergistic effect with that glyphosate. It's not just the gluten, but it's the glyphosate as well. The glyphosate
right.
plus the gluten. So, but
right.
the glyphosate by itself is a bad actor. I mean, it's an endocrine disturber. So it goes into your hormone system and wreaks havoc with it. And it's just hard to find clean food. But you're right, that, you know, that'd be a huge step toward a clean food system. Absolutely
right.
huge to get rid of glyphosate.
Right. Well, there's, you know, what it looks like to me is the consumer is getting smarter and smarter. And I think that's probably reflected in the Texas Depository, just the legislating getting passed, because I'm hearing huge demand for depositories you can trust that are much more easily, you know, accessible.
Yes.
So a state that has a depository, and even if it's not every county, but every other county, oof.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
That state's going to get a lot of immigration from other states.
Yeah, I don't know what about Texas for sure, but it's probably, if it were its own country, it would probably have one of the 20 largest economies in the world.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, it would probably rank up there. Yeah.
Okay, well, Franklin, this has been most informative. We're going to have your charts up on the website and,
okay.
of course, in the transcript. And, you know, I think this is going to be a very... I'm certainly telling anybody who doesn't have a core position, this summer is an opportunity to buy and fill up your core position.
Yeah,
and,
I think
I just think it's going to be a very interesting fall because... I just think trust in the system is really at a... the politics here are at a real inflection point. And so if we don't get a cleaning of the House, we're going to have a very interesting 2017.
Well, let's just hope we get a house cleaning. How about that? I just keep praying for that house cleaning.
I have one great ally who always says, our circumstances are far too dire for the luxury of realism. Okay, Franklin, you have a great day. Thank you again so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye.